I present a paper that co-authored together with a very good friend from our University of Bucharest, Radu Uscai, is part of a larger project that we have. And so if there are really difficult objections, I'll make sure to send them to Radu. He's not here, so I have an easy scapegoat. Yeah. Okay, this is a little story that I really like. It's recounted in a book from 2010 by a German philosopher of economics. And apparently, the story goes like Tobin, the famous economist, famous for his proposal of a worldwide new tax. To be remembered for the proposal of a tax is quite a sad destiny for an economist, but this is Tobin, and in a conference he snapped at it that knows it. There's nothing more dangerous than a philosopher who's learned a little bit of economics, to which the witty Nozick answered, unless it's an economist who hasn't learned any philosophy. So what we're trying to do broadly, and this is a token of this kind of work, is to take learning just a little bit of economics, to take some economics and see if we can extract moral or philosophical juice out of it. And what we're going to take today is some economic effects of intellectual property rights, and more exactly, drug patents, so pharmaceutical property, intellectual property rights. And these are the assumptions. The first assumption is that becoming a better person is a morally praiseworthy life goal. Furthermore, if tweaking somehow biochemical processes in our bodies to drugs or other medical procedures, surgery and so on and so forth, if that proves an effective way of achieving the goal of becoming a better person without harming significantly self, yourself or other parties, we take biochemical enhancement as at least a legitimate means as the more traditional forms of enhancement. Moral education, the practice of virtues, and so on and so forth. Differently put, we are quite happy to assume that later professors, Sobolescu and Persson, will definitely refute all the possible objections to enhancement. So we're already members of the parish, no problem there, quite happy with that. But the second assumption is that the economic arguments regarding the consequences of artificial scarcity that are actually induced by intellectual property framework are correct. However, they need not to be decisive against intellectual property. I mean, maybe there are this sort of bad economic effects, and still we can have overwhelming moral reasons maybe to support intellectual property. But we're just going to explore these consequences a bit and see where they lead us. So what is the question here? What are the likely consequences of the current IP legal framework, mainly drug patents, for those individuals who are willing to allocate scarce resources, like money, for achieving moral enhancement through biochemical means? Buying the drugs, paying for their surgical procedures, and so on and so forth. And our argument is that there are two types of morally relevant and economically triggered effects. So I'm only going to address here the question of voluntary enhancement. We assume away somehow the idea that we should or should not have government programs and so on and so forth. What do individuals freely choosing to become better persons through biochemical enhancement would face as a result of how intellectual property rights actually work? And some key distinctions, I'll just pass really fast through this because I'm sure everyone is familiar with the basics. An intellectual property right is a property right in ideal objects, always. But the ideal objects are instantiated in their material substrate, books, and for example, drugs, procedures, and so on and so forth. So differently stated, Nora Byron has given this formulation in an article from 2010 in Monist. An intellectual property right is a property right in an ideal type, while more traditional property rights, the property right over this glass, for example, refer to tokens rather than types. So if I'm the owner of this glass, the holder of the right, it's over this glass. If I'm the holder of a patent, it's not over one pill, it's over all the tokens of the type, of the respective type, right? So what is covered by intellectual property? Copyrights, patents, trademarks, and industrial secrets. We only consider pharmaceutical patents here in this paper, although we admit that other kinds of IP might also have some bearing on this issue. For example, industrial secrets. What is the economics of drug patents? A patent can represent a property right regarding an invention, a machinery of a certain type of process which have a useful function. That's always in the legal definition of a patent, a useful function. And drug patents in particular refer to either chemical formulas or types of processes producing these formulas. They grant the holder, which should be, not always, is the inventor, a limited monopoly over the new drug, limited in time, 20 years in most legislations. In effect, she has a right of excluding others from benefiting or utilizing, using without her permission, the results of her intellectual work. While there are other justifications, one could produce a Lockean mixing the labor argument for intellectual property, for example, in favor of granting the invention a patent, the most common argument in the and interdisciplinary, in a sense, argument rests on the economic importance of incentives. For example, in Posner and Landes, in their book from 2003, the argument is something like this: because the cost of copying an idea is so low, practically always almost for free, inventors need to be incentivized through a limited monopoly granted by a patent. Otherwise, they wouldn't have the motivation to invent, to be creative, if they don't get this protection offered by intellectual property. So the intended consequence of patents is to offer an inventor an incentive to get creative somehow. As the argument generally goes, the pharmaceutical industry shows all the signs of a traditional paradigmatic Schumpeterian industry. Large fixed cost, small and constant marginal cost, and innovation as the main competitive tool. So very vulnerable to creative destruction. So property rights usually are, let's say, in a Humean fashion, appear usually in the context of scarcity. And one of their functions, back to Hume, is that of internalizing negative externalities. But Hume says to avoid the possibility of conflict over scarce resources. That's why we need property rights, be them private or not private, common. However, note an important difference. Material objects are rare by themselves. Ideas, however, are not. In effect, it is precisely the introduction of property rights that create artificial scarcity. I mean, if I have two apples and Emilian steals an apple from me, I only have at T2 one apple. If I have two ideas, Emilian steals one idea from me, I still have two ideas. So that's a blunt way of showing that ideas are not scarce in economically relevant sense. So what is the economic effect of artificial scarcity? Like the effect of any kind of scarcity, less availability and higher price, resulting from the monopoly power of the holder of that intellectual property, right? And also a decrease in consumption, and I'll come back to that later. So we have seen this. It's already very well documented and quite dramatic. The introduction of the TRIPS agreement, intellectual property, meant that poorer countries, less affluent countries, were also under the obligation to observe the international rules for intellectual property. And let's look at the South Africa case. A 1-year supply of the most common HIV treatment combination from the major drug companies protected by that cost a staggering $1,200 per year. The generic equivalent of the same drug combination would be $350, while the average daily income at when the study was issued, shortly after the introduction of TRIPS, was $7 per day. So this was observed by, this was noticed by many authors. Let me just say that we're not supporting in any way the solution proposed, for example, by Pogge and Riemer, that of the international or World Health Impact Fund or something like that. But I think they point to the problem quite rightly. Back to enhancement now. We think that there are two disincentive effects for enhancement. First disincentive effect. We could quite safely assume that bioenhancement is not what economists call a weapon good. I mean, the demand for BME here stands for biological moral enhancement. We just compressed the following a convention offered by one of Julian's critics. So the demand for biological moral enhancement has a certain degree of price elasticity. If price goes up, then demand would go down. If so, then a higher relative price for BME drugs will lead to a smaller quantity demanded by consumers. But who are exactly the consumers responsible for the decrease in demand? And they are the same that would have to pay a higher opportunity cost for purchasing the drugs, and these are the worst off. Right. That is not to say that it's not possible to have a decrease in the demand for biological enhancement drugs by the rich, but it's more likely that statistically you would have more of a decrease in the demand for enhancement from the poor. Okay. It seems straightforward, but maybe it's too quick. Maybe biological moral enhancement is actually a weapon good. Maybe the demand is inelastic with regard to prices. And okay, there are two ways actually of formulating such an objection. The first one would be, well, maybe biological moral enhancement, drugs, is a positional good. Something like luxury cars. The demand increases as the price goes up because it's a sign of status. But if this is the kind of good that BME drugs, biological moral enhancement drugs, is, then we're very happy with the objection because it does the work of our argument instead of us doing the work. The objection actually shows that biological moral enhancement drugs would primarily be desired by and available for the rich. Maybe there's another way to put it. Maybe the motivation to attain moral enhancement is so strong, actually, that individuals will disregard price increases for enhancement drugs or procedures. This would seemingly look like a more promising line, but Although such a state of affairs might be desired, I mean, we would want to live maybe in a counterfactual world where everybody would have this priority of being a better person and buying the drugs needed for that. As things stand, we conjecture that it's rather implausible, because the best indicator is that we have the traditional forms of enhancement available, and people just, I mean, they do not seem to crowd up in our classrooms where we teach ethics. How come? If moral enhancement would have this status as an existential priority, then we would observe individuals willing to sacrifice other goals or the enjoyment of other pleasures, let's say, in order to pursue the more traditional and already available forms of enhancement. So a more plausible thing to say would be that the desire to be a better person, or the desire to be morally enhanced, occupies actually different places in the preference orderings of various agents. For some agents, it might be top priority. Other agents might be, well, maybe, why not, who knows. For others, it would be the lowest priority. And it would be at least adventurous to assume that moral enhancement is an essential priority for all individuals. And again, then, who would be the likely buyer and user of a relatively more expensive being drug? It would be individuals who already very strongly desire to become morally enhanced. So, one, Chris Zerpentine has this formulation of the bad apple problem. One of the ideas by proponents of moral enhancement would be that it can solve, sure, not the voluntary enhancement, but rather through government programs and so on and so forth, it could solve the bad apple problem. Morally, really repugnant individuals. But as concerns voluntary enhancement, we can ask ourselves, are agents, persons, individuals who are strongly motivated to become better persons, ceteris paribus, better persons than agents who do not have this priority? I think one could quite plausibly put forward an argument that somebody who really and consistently and always wants to be a better person is already a reasonably good person. If you have this internalized moral motives, then you're at least on the right side of morality. So, with artificial scarcity, okay, and price increases, the agents would be willing to voluntarily embark on a quest for biological moral enhancement might not be the ones that need it the most, but rather the ones that are already projecting themselves in terms of moral improvement. So, just two more phrases. I think our argument supports the weak form that drug patents provide some disincentives, at least for voluntary moral enhancement. I don't think our argument supports the strong version, but hopefully we'll get there sometimes, that you cannot, one cannot be consistently both a supporter of moral enhancement and intellectual property. But hopefully we'll get there and get you guys against intellectual property.